Hello, I'm Julie Gedeon. This is number 0494, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0494. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Marty Vargas, author of A Place for You, which shares the story of the search for his homeless birth mother, who was on the streets for over 20 years.
Basically on and off, but mostly on than off, meaning that she lived in shelters. She lived in, you know, sometimes she had some places to live, but those are all short-lived. And so she was basically homeless most of the time for 28 years. I was able to document everything about her life, and, you know, I began to learn a lot about her. But I didn't know her growing up, actually. I never really remember ever meeting her. And it wasn't until I was about 20, 21 years old that I went to go find her.
Stephen David Elliott is the author of Mingle, The Art of Face-to-Face Networking in the Digital Era. He talks about face-to-face communication in the social media world.
Social media is a tool. It's a very powerful tool. Just like when we used to use, you know, a phone as a tool, a Rolodex, which the millennials wouldn't even know what we're talking about, that was the tool. Now we are in the age of social media and CRMs, which makes it that we can be more effective as a networker. We can leverage and use that tool so we can maintain a larger network where we can keep in touch with those people face-to-face in a more efficient and better manner.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0494, was Julie Gedeon, a writer and editor of Montreal Home and various other magazines throughout North America. She also teaches writing in Hudson, Quebec, and you can find out more about her and her writer's kitchen at www.eloquence.online. That's www.eloquence.online. And of course, you can go to the website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which, as you just heard Julie mention, is number 0494, and you'll find the links to Julie's page. See how it all comes full circle? See how it all comes around back to where we started? Synergy. That's how it works. Thank you very much, Julie, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. Okay, so you're a 14-year-old girl who desperately wants to visit her boyfriend late at night, but you don't have transportation to get you there. What to do? Oh, what to do? Oh, I know. How about calling to have a pizza delivered to your neighbor's house, then steal the delivery vehicle? Yeah. A teenage girl stole a pizza delivery driver's car in Lehigh Acres, Florida. Josie Bigelow is accused of stealing the driver's car as he was outside completing a delivery to a neighbor's house shortly after midnight. The driver, identified as 49-year-old Christopher Cook, told deputies he saw a person come out of the woods as he was walking up to the house's front door. The person then got into his car and drove through the front yard and along a canal before getting away. Eventually, an aviation unit spotted the car pull into a driveway about 6 miles away. That's where deputies found Bigelow. The girl's father said his daughter ordered the pizza so she could steal the driver's car to visit her boyfriend. However, the house where the car was parked was not her boyfriend's. Those who lived there said that they never had seen the car and were shocked to wake up to deputies. It is believed she tried to ditch the car there to no avail. Bigelow was arrested and booked on recommended charges of grand theft of a motor vehicle. She has since been released. Cook's car has been returned, and he said he gave the pizza to the responding deputies. You see, this is the problem we have today. Now, back in my day, we baby boomers were everywhere. We didn't have to go 6 miles to date someone. Kids were overstuffed into every house and apartment on the block. As for Josie, I'm sure her father will lower the boom and not allow his daughter to have boyfriends or pizza. Yeah. Meanwhile, residents in northern Kansas City, Missouri, said they had complained about their mail carrier, but the U.S. Postal Service might actually listen now after the unnamed carrier tried to get his truck up an icy hill. There was a point where, for almost 10 minutes straight, he did not let up on the gas, said Brian Riley, yet he wasn't moving the entire time. He was pushing it beyond insanity, and you could just tell the way he was going that he was getting more and more mad the whole time. The postie finally had to stop and jump out to save his life when the truck exploded into flames and slid on the ice down the hill, barely missing several cars and coming to rest on a home's lawn. All the mail on board burned, but there was one positive in the whole mess. That's the one and only time, Raleigh said, I've ever actually seen our mailman get out of his vehicle. Wow. Neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. Unless, of course, the courier is a moron who's bad at his job, short-tempered, and lacks any common sense. In that case, all bets are off. A Florida Keys man pulled over for speeding Christmas Eve locked his keys inside his car when Monroe County Sheriff's Office deputies told him that they were going to search the vehicle. 40-year-old Albert Garcia had reason to worry. Deputies found small amounts of cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, amphetamine pills, and marijuana inside the Lexus. Garcia was arrested on multiple felony drug possession counts, felony driving with a suspended license, because they always have a suspended license, and misdemeanor marijuana possession and misdemeanor obstruction. Garcia was pulled over shortly after 11 p.m. after being clocked on radar driving his Lexus at 70 miles per hour in a 45 mile per hour zone. Garcia was asked for his license, but he said it was suspended but would soon be reinstated. According to police reports, Garcia's license had been suspended since April of 2012, and he had been arrested for driving on a suspended license 3 previous times. He also had a warrant out for his arrest for not showing up in court for a traffic violation. After police said they were going to search the Lexus, Garcia threw the keys inside the vehicle and locked the doors. A towing company unlocked the car, and deputies searched the vehicle, finding the drugs. You know, throwing the keys in the car and locking the doors is the same kind of thought process that a toddler has when covering their eyes with their hands to play peekaboo. Yeah. Not really a sense of reality for this guy. But we have another story that deals with searching a car that has a completely different twist to it. And by the way, this is our last story in this section of the Stuff File News before we get to our first guest here on the program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. 29-year-old Matt Krull spent 41 days in jail, wrongly accused. He was locked up over Christmas and New Year's, but he and 10 others are out now, and the deputy who arrested them has been fired. Krull had a white powdery substance that was found in the driver's side door, wrapped in plastic with a hair tie around it. Krull said it was Tide laundry detergent. Deputy Stephen O'Leary said it was heroin. A lot of heroin. I just looked at him baffled and confused because I had no idea as to where 92 grams of heroin came from inside my van, Krull said. Krull says he bought the Astro van about 3 weeks prior for $1,400, so maybe the last owner had left it behind. But the street price of 92 grams could be worth more than $18,000. Krull was parked at a Jensen Beach, Florida KFC restaurant, asleep in the van on December the 5th. He admits he had taken a sip of a Budweiser that was in the cup holder. Krull was one of 11 people freed from jail because whatever drug O'Leary said it was turned out to be something legal. All of the charges for all 11 people have been dropped. Krall said he wasn't sure if he was going to sue. So, what the cop thought was heroin turned out to be Tide detergent, but Krall spent 41 days in jail. Oh, he should sue. Unless he's afraid that the cops dropped the drug charge, only to charge him later with, you know, laundering. Yeah, I had to go there. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Marty Vargas has a remarkable story to share. At birth, he and his mother were homeless. They were found sleeping in the snow in Philadelphia. As an infant, he was put up for adoption, and 20 years later, he found his estranged birth mother. Marty shares that story in his book, A Place for You. Marty joins us on the line right now from New York. Hi, Marty.
Hi. It's my privilege. Thank you, Peter. It's a blessing to be here with you.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, you were put up for adoption, and 20 years later, you found your mother. During that 20-year period, was she always homeless?
Yes. I mean, you know, basically on and off, but mostly on than off, meaning that she lived in shelters. She lived in, you know, sometimes she had some places to live, but those are all short-lived. And, you know, and so she was basically homeless most of the time for 28 years. And I was able to document everything about her life. And, you know, I began to learn a lot about her. But I didn't know her growing up, actually. I never really remember ever meeting her. And it wasn't until I was about 20, 21 years old that I went to go find her.
And when you first started that search at 20, 21 years old, how long did it take before you actually did find her?
Well, you know, it wasn't a long time. It took me a matter of several weeks, you know, maybe a couple weeks. And but what happened is we knew family who knew basically generally where she was. And but it wasn't the difficulty finding her, even though it was hard. What it was trying to get her off the streets, because she didn't want to come off the streets when we eventually, you know, when we ultimately found her. And she was very, very resistant. And it took a number of years then to get her off the streets after finding her initially. And when I found her in a homeless shelter. And it was a very surreal situation because we had searched now through the library about articles written about my mom. We had interviews with people and talks with people and trying to find her. We went through every street that we possibly can, down different alleys in the night, and eventually we came across a shelter. And my cousin Joanne had called earlier that day to all the shelters in Philadelphia looking for Rachel. And apparently people, you know, pretty much knew about my mom because she had lived there in 9th Street for over 20 years, in the streets actually, on 9th Street. Now 9th Street is that classic street that is used in the movie Rocky, where Rocky, you know, Sylvester Stallone is running down the street as Rocky and they're selling things in the Italian market. My mother sort of haunted that area on a regular basis. And so when Joanne hit that particular shelter, it struck a chord with the people. And so we went eventually searching through the streets. We finally said, let's try this shelter. And we found her there. And I remember that moment when the door flung open and a young woman was smiling from ear to ear, and we asked for Rachel, and she said, your mother's a beautiful person. And they led us down this long cement corridor, and at the end of that corridor, when the doors opened, there was my mother, and they led us up into this black gymnasium. It was just total blackness, except for a light beaming down on the stage in the center of that gymnasium. And it was there, I sat down, she sat down, and my cousin said, Aunt Ray, this is your son, Marty. Marty, this is your mom. And that was one of the most amazing experiences in my life, you know. And I was trying to figure out, how is it that she lived 20 years at that time, 20 plus years in the streets? And she was just a total mystery to me. And that precipitated me to eventually go on and start studying her life and interviewing people and doing research what precipitated her to live in such an abode of hell, you know, and through some of the most harshest weather conditions. And my mother's teeth were missing due to being beat in the streets. Her hands were large and callous and clawed. Her feet were eroding due to the dirt that oozed its way through the seams of her shoes. But, you know, for me, she may have been repulsive to other people, but she was irresistible. She was my mom, and I finally found her. You know what I'm saying?
Now, you mentioned you mentioned that you had a cousin that was helping you look for her. Was this cousin cousin by adoption, or was it another natural relative of yours? And did you find other natural relatives once you found your mom?
Oh man, you asked one of the most mind-blowing questions. You see, I was adopted into the family, and so this cousin was my adoptive cousin. But what turned everything around for me and flipped me over was I never knew who my father was. And I had just come to Philadelphia, not initially to find my mother, but to bury my adoptive brother, who had died in California. We transported his body to Philly. And then it was then I started looking for my mom. And then when I found her, I asked her, I said, "Who is my father?" And she said, "Nan is your father." And Nan was my adoptive brother that I had just buried. And so I grew up all my life believing this man was my brother. And in reality, it wasn't an incestuous situation. In reality, he was actually my blood father. And so the secret was kept away from me for all those years. So my cousin, that means my cousin, my actual blood cousin. And the people who adopted me were the people who found me sleeping in the snow with my mom. And they didn't even know that they were actually my real grandparents. And it wasn't until I was 13 years old when all the files were brought in and all the story came out that they realized I was their actual real grandson. But they never told me that. So it was when I was about 20, 21 years old when I found my mother living in the streets, I found out who my real father was, and I had just buried him.
So you always thought your actual father was indeed your adoptive brother.
Yeah.
And I assume since your parents or grandparents, your real grandparents knew the story, I assume that your father knew the story and he never discussed it with you ever.
Yeah, and that was the tragedy of the whole thing, because he actually came to California, because I grew up in California. I didn't, you know, my grandparents were very intelligent and they knew they had to get me out of South Philadelphia lest I would find out who my mother was, lest I would grow up in the streets and, you know, become a gangbanger, you know. And so they moved us to California. And what happened is 20 years later, my adopted brother, who was still living in Philadelphia, came to California to tell me that he was my father. But the night after he arrived, or the day after he arrived in California, he had a massive heart attack and died. And so I grew up all my life believing he was my brother, and then we transported him back to Philadelphia area, in New Jersey, Philadelphia, Eastern area, to bury him. And that's when I found out that he was my real father. And the reason why I know that is his wife told me, he said, the reason why we came to California is that, you know, his life had changed and he felt, you know, he had to make things right and he wanted to tell you he was your father.
Okay, so you spend time searching for your birth mother. I'm sure your family was aware of the fact that you were searching for your birth mother. Why wasn't your father searching for your birth mother?
Yeah, this is a very good question. And I have to go into, you know, shortly, about a second or two, into the backstory of my mother. My mother was a totally normal person. And what happened is she went through a series of events that precipitated her into the streets. And there was violence, there was abuse, not by my natural father, but by her husband. And she was locked up into a mental institution because he had locked her up. And a lot of terrible things happened to her, which I documented through records and medical records, etc. And in my book. And what happened was, I don't know, he felt ashamed that he had this affair with her, you know, or this relationship with her. And so he never came out, you know, with, this is my son. And from my counseling experience working with so many other people, there are so many men out there that do have other children, illegitimate, but never come out with that. And so it was tragic in that sense. And my mother got to the point where she didn't want to come off the streets because of all the things that had happened to her. And you know, she was there for many years. She was raped in the streets many times. Matter of fact, when I was doing my documentary that aired on television, I was out there with cameras and everything. A lady came up and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm doing a documentary on a homeless lady." And she said, "Rachel?" And she actually called my mother's name. I said, "Yes, how'd you know?" She said, "We used to find her babies dead in the street." And so my mother got to the point where she was so demoralized and to the point that she was really a spectacle. You know, she smelled like defecation. She was, you know, putrefactually, you know, how can you say it, obnoxious in the sense that not in attitude, but in appearance and everything. She looked like a crazy homeless, out of your mind type of homeless person. But the beautiful thing about it is that, you know, love eventually changed her. And by the time she died, no one would have ever known she lived 28 years living in the streets. She became coherent. Her mind was healed. She was just normal, like just you and I, and would hold a coherent conversation and was adorable in so many ways. But these events that took place in her life created this devastation. And for somehow, for some reason, she was kept there. And like that's why I document all that in the book, her backstory, what happened to her, how she got there, why she remained. You know, those particular questions that kind of prick our minds when we see someone like this. And it totally changed the way I think about homeless people. And my story is really not about homelessness. It's really about hope and how love can change things.
We're talking with Marty Vargas, who is the author of A Place for You, which tells the story of his search for his biological mother, a woman who was living homeless on the streets of Philadelphia. By the way, you can go to Marty's website at martyvargas.com. That's where you can find his book. Also, you can go to amazon.com, and the link for that is on our website at thestufffile.com. We'll continue talking with Marty. We'll take a quick break here on The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. On the air, on stations in Singapore, New Zealand, and America, and streaming through your computer. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
We are talking with Marty Vargas, who is the author of A Place for You, which tells the story of how he went out to look for his biological mom, who was homeless. Did you find out if you had any other natural siblings?
Yes, I did. I found out that I had a sister that predated me, and she was not in a homeless situation. Neither did she live in the streets. My mother kept me alive in the streets for about 7 months, and that all happened after my sister was taken away from my mother because she and her husband, there were some difficulties there, and I found her, but she didn't want to talk about my mother. She rejected. You know, it was an embarrassment, I guess. I don't know. But she would not deal with the issue of her homeless mother. I found through hospital records that I have a brother that was born in 1971. A police officer actually delivered him, found my mother giving birth in the streets, rushed her to the hospital. The moment they got into the lobby of the hospital, she gave birth, and the police officer had caught him coming out. And from sources that I know that were in those areas, is that the back in that time is the police officer that actually took the child. He actually adopted the child away from my mother. And so I was not able to really ever find him. I hope by the interview on this program and others that somehow I might be able to flesh him out and find him and to tell him the truth about his own personal life. But yeah, those are the two that I know that are alive. And, you know, hopefully one day with God's help, I'll find them.
You mentioned that your sister, the sister you found, rejected the idea of discussing or talking about your mom. Did you feel that in her rejection of your mother, she was also rejecting you?
Yes. I felt that. I didn't take it in a personal way because I could understand. But it's like, you know how it is sometimes. People don't want to face something, don't want to deal with it. And fortunately, I was able to do that. You know, I was precipitated into it, and I couldn't help but, you know, find out these things. But at the same time, I had a driving desire to help my mom. It took me years to get her off the streets, and I depleted my bank account as a student in college. I quit college. I gave up everything. I was out in the streets with her for months, you know, and finally it paid off years later. But my sister, I think it was something that was a total embarrassment to her, and I can't fault her for that. You know what I'm saying? Everyone is at their own personal level of how they deal with the true background to their life, you know?
How does all this experience, first, you know, going through the idea and finding out that you're adopted, finding out that your mother is homeless, doing the search for her, finding her, how does that affect the psyche of a young boy, a young man? How does it affect you growing up?
Yeah, thank you. Prior to finding her, I felt very normal. For the exception, I can't say abnormal when I say exception, for the fact that I felt like I wasn't original in my family. And I resented being adopted. And I remember at age 13, when the adoption finally went through years later, at age 13, resenting having to acknowledge that I'm now part of the family that I've always been a part of. And so it wasn't until I was older and I wrote the book and I realized, as I was contemplating and as I was taking care of my mother, I said to her one day, why'd you give me up? You know, didn't you love me enough? And I guess that's just an emotional response. But then I think God was opening my heart and my mind to begin to realize, you know, if my mother kept me, I would have been dead, you know. And so it was a very sacrificial, you know, action that she took. In letting me go to somebody that would love me and take care of me, because she couldn't do it. And so my resentment was eventually receded and dissipated, and I realized, you know, this was all for the better good, you know.
You have the opportunity to be angry at several people. You could be angry at your natural father. You could be angry at your parents, your adoptive parents, for not telling you earlier who your natural father was. You could be angry with your mother for giving you up, as you said earlier. You could be angry with her actual husband, who may be the catalyst to starting the spiral that your mother was on. Are you angry with any of these people?
No, you know, when I look back at my life, I'm very grateful for December 16th. That's when I was born. The fact that I came into this world, and I look back and I resolved the issue with my mom. It was like, you know, thank God she gave me up. Thank God this elderly couple took me in and they cared for me and they loved me. And I had so much love in that home. It was incredible. And my father, you know, he never gave me anything. But what he gave me was a story that I can tell the whole world, you know, to give other people hope. I didn't resent him. I loved him as my brother coming up. But then, you know, when I found out who he was, what he was, I was really thankful, because he gave me a part of who I am. And both my mom, even though she was homeless, she gave me this persistence never to give up. And he gave me the other side of that. And he gave me his parents, which were so loving and wonderful, and I always felt like I had the best parents in the whole wide world.
You mentioned that your mom had passed away. How much time did you have with her between the time that you found her and she became, as you say, an average normal person no longer living on the street? How much time did you have with her before she died?
Oh, wow, that's an excellent question. It was on and off, you know, because she came to live with me and when I initially got her off the streets, and it took me 2 years after finding her to get her off the streets to live with me. But then she jumped out of my second story window. She broke 8 bones in her body. She used to run away. It was a very devastating situation for me. And then, of course, we got separated again. And then finally, when she was ready, she came entirely home. And I took care of her the last 6 years of her life. And it was one of the most beautiful experiences of my life.
So you would say that in the 6 years prior to her death, it was, for lack of a better term, a healed relationship between the two of you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was an issue. You know, my mother didn't trust people in general, you know, and everything that went through. And what happened was I had to choose to personally love her. And I realized that when I first found her in the streets. You know, I'm kind of a germaphobe. I don't like dirtiness and anything like that. And it was hard for me to relate to it. But then finally, I made the choice to love her. And she sensed that and felt that love. But it took years to prove that love. And, you know, it broke me. I had to let go of my pride. I had to let go of who I thought I was and embrace my situation. And she sensed that and she felt the love. And she loved me, and we had a good relationship.
It's a fascinating story. It's chronicled in a book, A Place for You, which is written by Marty Vargas. Marty, I thank you for being on the program. I do have one more question that I want to ask you, though, and that is, has the experience that you've gone through with your mom, with your family, who you didn't realize was actually your family, with all that has taken place in your life, how has it affected you, if at all, in your own personal relationships?
Yeah, it helped me to be more understanding with people and to be patient with other people. You know, I'm not perfect at it by any means, but it helped me understand that everyone has a story behind them. And those stories sometimes are what really shapes the person and their character and their reaction to their events that have taken place in their lives. And it's, you know, taken me into a journey of other people's lives and trying to care and to try to be loving and understanding, though I'm not perfect at it by any means, but it's given me a glimpse to understand people and to take them where they are.
The book is called A Place for You. It's written by Marty Vargas. Marty, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. It's a fascinating story.
Well, Peter, it's just an honor to be on your program. Thank you for having me.
Marty Vargas, author of A Place for You. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0494, and you'll find links to Marty's site, where you'll also find his book, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob Dorigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Think you're good at political trivia? Let's see if you can guess what famous political leader made this comment. Here's the quote. Regulators all too often encourage or approve unreasonably high prices, inadequate service, and anti-competitive behavior. The cost of this regulation is always passed on to the consumer, and that cost is astronomical. End of quote. If you're thinking Donald Trump, good guess, but it's wrong. Cutting government regulation is a popular topic these days, but that comment was made more than 30 years ago. Now that you know that, you may be thinking Ronald Reagan, but that's wrong too. Let's be fair, it's easy to think of one political party when we think of deregulation, but that statement was made by the former liberal U.S. Senator, Ted Kennedy. You see, in the 1970s, Kennedy led the effort to deregulate the airline industry. He lowered fares, revolutionized flying, and revealed the benefits of deregulation. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, coming to you from Montreal, Canada.
where we share the longest unprotected border in the world with the United States. Take that as a sign of extreme friendship, or a warning.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Mingle, The Art of Face-to-Face Networking in the Digital Era. Plus, we do indeed have an Idiot of the Day coming your way, and more Stuff File news here on a show that is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard on Google Play and iTunes. Just click on the Google Play or iTunes button located on the website at thestufffile.com, and whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. That would be greatly appreciated. Let's get back to the stuff. 40-year-old Laura Ullin showed up 15 minutes late for her hair appointment at a Cape Coral, Florida salon, bringing along three or four children. According to witnesses, when Ullin was told she had to wait, she replied, "Well, there seems to be a lot of talking and no work." Another customer told Ullin to take a chill pill, and Ullin responded by yelling and cursing. A client placed herself between Ullin and the stylist, who was the target of her rage, and witnesses say Ullin then pulled a gun out of her purse, pointed it at the woman, and told her to back up. When someone said they were calling the police, Ullin left. Officers went to her house, found a loaded gun, and arrested her. Ullin was charged with carrying an unlicensed firearm and assault with a deadly weapon without intent to kill. Okay, I haven't seen her mugshot yet, but I'm assuming that in it, she's having a bad hair day. You know, if she shows up late for her arraignment, that judge is going to hear about it too. Yeah. Okay, so this next guy isn't exactly Father of the Year, since we were just talking about someone who's probably not Mother of the Year. Now, it is possible to be forgetful, so you're probably going to want an explanation as to how 29-year-old Arsenio Humphrey ended up leaving his 3-year-old son in a car, unattended, a vehicle, by the way, that was running and unlocked. Oh, it's simple. He was just running into a grocery store in Susquehanna Township, Pennsylvania. But leaving his kid in the car wasn't the crime that initially got him arrested. You see, I said he was going into a grocery store. I didn't say he was planning on paying for anything. Humphrey faces charges after police say he tried to steal crab legs by stuffing them down his pants. Well, down one's pants is where you usually find crabs. Anyway, Humphrey was taken into custody after he was found putting crab legs down the front of his pants and leaving the store without paying for them. The child in the car was released to a relative, and Dauphin County Child and Youth was made aware of the incident. Yeah, I don't think he should get that kid back anytime soon. And I also hope that crab legs isn't on the menu in prison.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
This is an important self-serving promotional bulletin. My book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars, is still available. And like the title says, within the pages you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer. Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner. Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar. A host of TV icons, plus two guys who left their footprints on the moon. Order it now. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and for your e-reader on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher's website at BearManorMedia.com. All links are on our website at TheStuffFile.com. So, buy the book. What are you waiting for? This has been an important self-serving promotional bulletin.
I love you. Now, back to our show.
The clerk at an adult novelty store in St. Louis, Missouri, was confronted by an armed robber. He pointed a gun at her and said he would kill her in 30 seconds if she didn't open the cash register for him. And then he started his count. 1 Mississippi. 2 Mississippi. 3 Mississippi. The woman opened the register and handed over the cash. Upon seeing security camera footage from the store, police officers recognized the robber and arrested 39-year-old John Dwayne Phillips, Jr. John Dwayne Phillips, Sr. must be oh so proud of his namesake. You know, even though he was in St. Louis, he, of course, used the Mississippi, the grade school standard for measuring a second, because counting Missouris wouldn't have been long enough. Three customers and staff at a Wells Fargo branch in Solana Beach, California, were stunned on January 3rd when 35-year-old Clint Gray entered the bank shortly after it opened and yelled, "This is a robbery! Everybody get on the ground!" But Gray, who was unarmed, didn't follow through. Instead, he stripped down to his underwear and sat in a chair near the front door, asking bank employees to call law enforcement. He also kindly told one female customer that she could sit in the chair instead of lying on the floor. A sheriff's deputy arrived shortly and Gray surrendered without resistance. He was later charged with attempted robbery. Now seriously, how much of an attempt was that? I kind of get the feeling this is a guy who just wants to be in jail. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, police say a woman smashed her way into a closed Pennsylvania police station looking for an officer she'd been sexually harassing ever since he arrested her. Police say 27-year-old Ashley Keister of Nanticoke used a large cigarette butt receptacle to smash glass doors into the West Wyoming Police Building at around 12:45 a.m., Once inside, she started rummaging through file cabinets. West Wyoming Police Chief Curtis Nocera says Keister had been under investigation for harassing an officer who arrested her last year. He says she sent sexually harassing messages on social media and would call 911 just to talk to him. The break-in was caught on surveillance cameras. Keister was charged with aggravated assault on a police officer, burglary, and vandalism. You know, some people really, 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 really love a man in uniform, whether that man in uniform wants to be loved or not. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? It would seem that the more people use social media, the less they actually spend time in face-to-face communication. But physical networking can bring about big opportunities for you and your business. Stephen David Elliott is the author of Mingle, The Art of Face-to-Face Networking in the Digital Era. He joins us on the line from North Carolina. Hi, Stephen. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing great, Peter. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. The situation that you're talking about, Mingle, the art of face-to-face networking, it seems like we're just going old school. There was a time when we would all mingle. That's how we got things done. Social network has seemed to have changed that. Is it difficult to get people, especially the younger generation who grew up totally with networking via social media? Do you find that this is a difficult challenge, a difficult process to get them to go back to what used to work before?
Yeah, I'm actually going to take a contrary position. I'm a Gen Xer. I'm 50 years old, and I use social media quite a bit, and as do my parents, who are baby boomers. We're on social media a lot. The millennials and the Gen Yers, they're actually starting to reject social media. They are going for experiences. They do want to meet people face to face. What we have to recognize is the old way is really the only way. The social media is a tool. It's a very powerful tool. Just like when we used to use, you know, a phone as a tool, a Rolodex, which the millennials wouldn't even know what we're talking about. That was a tool. Now we are in the age of social media and CRMs, which makes it that we can be more effective as a networker. We can leverage and use that tool so we can maintain a larger network where we can keep in touch with those people face to face in a more efficient and better manner.
Is there a happy medium? I mean, you know, there are some people who, again, like the face-to-face communication. There are some who like to use social media more. Is there, in your estimation, a happy medium and it's not one or the other?
Well, I think you really can't do one or the other. You have to do both. So, as I said, the social media is really a tool. So, I do company, you know, we run 155 networking events physical per month. We're the largest networking event company in the world for evening of business events, Rockstar Connect. So our database is enormous. We've had over 500,000 attendees in 2 years. So how do we keep in touch with those people and help our clients keep in touch with those people is by creating social media for them so that they can, you know, comment and like on posts by people that they have met, and also helping them to utilize tools like a CRM or a database where they can manage how they do their physical networking. Of having an electronic calendar, which we didn't have that even 10 years ago, is essential to effectively physically network. Because if we were networking all the time physically, and we were always on social media, when do we actually have money-making opportunities? You're meeting people, but when are you leveraging that network? When are you helping the people in the network, and when are they helping you? You use the social media and the database and the electronic calendars in order to help you achieve that.
Your website, by the way, is rockstarconnect.com. And as you say, you go around doing these events. At what point did you say, you know, I've got to put this down on paper. I've got to write this book. What was the push that came to shove when you said, I need to do this?
Well, We had the idea for writing the book, my partner and I, Nick Choppy, right when we started the company. And we wanted to create a book that was very easy to use, an actionable journal. Our clients, you know, the people that consume what we produce are very busy people. So the book is designed to be read in 10 to 20 minutes. It has a lot of the philosophy of networking in there. It gives you tips on how to run your own networking event, how to be a good participant with networking. There's room in there for you to write information about your experiences networking, and then go back to the book again and again to improve your ability in networking face-to-face.
In the short lifespan that we have done the online networking as opposed to face-to-face, has that changed in any way?
Yes, it has changed, because I think that people are using the tool incorrectly. People are going for the sale right away because they feel they have, you know, some anonymity in the sense that, well, there's no one there rejecting me right to my face. So they're always selling. And I think that's a real turnoff for most people. And they would rather create meaningful connections first before they start doing business with you. So as when you meet people face-to-face, you have the opportunity to do that. You wouldn't take your business card and tape it to their forehead, for example. You should use social media the same way. Tell people what you're about and why they should like you and why they should trust you. I just hired someone to do some work on my car, you know, strictly off social media. But then I got on the phone with him, and I had an hour-long conversation where I determined I trust this guy. I like him, and I want to do business with him. But still, I didn't commit to him until he comes out and looks at my vehicle. So there's steps to establishing that meaningful connection so that you can do business with one another. Also, you have to come from a position, if you're going to be a successful networker, as a giver. It's give value to your community, to individual people you're networking with, and then you do the ask for business. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I was going to ask you the question again about your book. When you wrote it, who did you see your prime reader as being, and who you felt would get the most out of what your book has to offer?
I think the book is fantastic for people that are new to networking. They're not having the success that they want. Maybe they're discouraged with the whole networking process. And it's also a good refresher for people that do network effectively to read it, to reinforce the good behavior and practices that they already have. So it's a book written for everyone that believes in creating a community, nurturing that community, helping that community, and then, of course, benefiting from it both materially and spiritually.
Now, I understand you also have an offer for readers, for listeners, rather, of this show pertaining to your book, correct?
Yes. This book was never created to be a money-making opportunity for myself or my company, Rockstar Connect. We just wanted to share our philosophy that you have to give in order to get. So any of your listeners or their friends or their family or colleagues can go to our website, rockstarconnect.com, go to the contact page and say, I want a free book. And we're going to send them a link so that they can have their own PDF copy. They can either read that online or they can print it out. Completely complimentary. We want to give to you, and especially to your listeners.
Now, tell us a little bit again about the work that you do, what's led up to this book in the first place. Tell us a little bit about Rockstar Connect.
Well, Rockstar Connect is really a result of my 30 years of working for myself as an entrepreneur. And I was very successful in what I've done, primarily by networking, by helping other people, providing information and connecting people. But what I found is when other people did it, either they would get to a certain point in their business where they weren't able to do it on their own. They weren't able to put together the events. They couldn't any longer meet and with 100 people in a month or go to 20 events. So we created Rockstar Connect as a company that does it for the networker, for the networking leader. So our clients are rock stars already. They're successful. They have a success mentality. The attendees of the events, they are the audience for the rock star. They're the beneficiaries of the event, and they're the brand evangelist for the group and for the leader of the group. Rockstar Connect, we're the roadies. We're doing the tens, up to 50 hours a week of work that is required to have a networking event so our hosts can show up at an event where the logistics is done for them. We're doing the heavy lifting, plugging in the guitars, setting up the speakers.
So besides going to the website to get a copy of your free book, Mingle, the Art of Face-to-Face Networking in the Digital Age, how can people take part in what you are doing on a regular basis? How can they be part of Rockstar Connect? Will they find out more information about that on the website as well?
Yes, on the website, there is a section called Events where they can find events near them. Just type in your city or click on the map, and they'll pop up. And if you're interested in having your own event and being a host of an event, you can reach out to us from the website as well. We also have a great business page with excellent content on Facebook called Rockstar Connect. And very likely, if we have an event in your area, you can join the social media groups on Facebook and meet up too.
Sounds like a plan. Stephen, I thank you very much for being on the program with us. Pleasure to talk to you.
Great talking to another man with three names.
Yes, that's Stephen David Elliott, author of Mingle, The Art of Face-to-Face Networking in the Digital Era. Again, if you want a free PDF copy of his book, you can find it by going to his website at rockstarconnect.com. Go to the contact page and just say that you want a free copy of Mingle. It's as simple as that. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0494, and you'll find the links to Stephen's page. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. We do have an idiot of the day coming up in just a moment, but I've got one more Stuff File news story that I want to share with you right here, right now. You know how we love truck spills on this show. So here's the latest. These chicken tenders aren't for pickup. An Alabama sheriff's office is warning people against eating chicken that tumbled onto a rural highway after a truck wreck. An 18-wheeler crashed on Alabama 35, spilling boxes of chicken tenders in Cherokee County near the Georgia line. Motorists began stopping to pick up the food, which authority says created a traffic hazard. The Cherokee County Emergency Management Agency posted a notice on its Facebook page asking people to quit picking up the chicken. The notice says that the food isn't safe to eat after hours on the ground. The post says the situation was creating a traffic hazard and it's a crime to block traffic. Violators could face charges. The sheriff's office says a wrecker crew was on the scene the next day cleaning up the mess. Wow. This scene has a sort of dystopian movie quality to it, where people come out grabbing spilled food in some sort of futuristic dumpster dive. Also, it kind of answers the question of why the chicken didn't cross the road. Yeah. Anyway, boys and girls, it's that time you've all been waiting for. The moment you desire. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Employees of a bank in Largo, Florida noticed that a man wearing a mask tried to enter the branch, but they hadn't opened yet for the day, and he fled on a bicycle when he found that the door was locked. Now, bank staff called police. So did a bank about a quarter mile away. The same man tried robbing them with a knife, but the tellers were behind safety glass and simply retreated, leaving the robber empty-handed. By then, the first bank was open, and sure enough, the robber came back, still wearing the mask and carrying the knife. The police officer taking the report from the first incident was still there and took 36-year-old Ronald Massey into custody. They noted that Massey had been released from prison just 6 days before after serving time for, wait for it, robbing two banks. Oh, dear Lord. Now why, oh why, would you try a feeble attempt at robbing two banks merely 6 days after you just got out of jail for robbing two banks? And why would you not even bother to check the hours the banks are open? And why would you go back to the first bank you tried to rob just minutes earlier for a second attempt? Well, the answer to all of these questions is one answer and one answer only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0494. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0494. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. We leave you with this deep environmental thought. If we don't do something about global warming soon, eventually there won't be any ice floes left to put our elders on.